Welcome to the Business Gist podcast. Today we've got Beth Miller, Chief Strategy and Marketing Officer at Magid. We're going to be talking about human-centered design and empathy in the workplace, or lack thereof. Welcome, Beth. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I am super excited to talk to you and learn more about what you're doing at Magid and what Magid does and how you got there.
Well, thank you for asking. I am born and raised Minneapolis, Minnesota. Love the cold, love being here. But I have a degree in design communications, and it's a Bachelor of Science degree from the University of Minnesota with an emphasis in graphic design. And design communications is all about human empathy, human understanding, and really getting to the core of a business problem or a solution, but shaping that around the needs of humans, of people, and taking it from that perspective versus just a marketing perspective.
What a novel idea.
Yeah, exactly. So what drew me to Magid is that they are a 60-year-old company that has been focused on understanding human behavior for that entire 60 years, a business entirely based on that, and looking at what those unmet needs are. We talk about the fact that we live between those 6 inches between your ears of a consumer, and we look at what is a derived response versus described. So you're listening between the lines for what people aren't saying. It would be human-centered design and that type of thinking and that empathetic approach that brought us things like smartphones. No one said, I needed a smartphone. We didn't even know we needed one, and now we know that we can't live without them.
Exactly. Well, so when you talk about between the lines, how do you get there?
We take this approach of human-centered business strategy. So it's asking a lot of questions. It's paying attention to what's not being said. It's watching what people are doing or what they say they're doing and then how those actions betray what they say that they are doing. And it's just paying attention to how people think. So we have, we hire on something that we call just an innate natural curiosity. We're looking for people who always watch and listen and wonder why someone is doing what they're doing and how we could make that better. But they want to understand what's compelling someone. So it's not just looking at big data and points of big data and trying to find correlations and patterns and push forward what we think people might do, mm-hmm. It's actually understanding what compelled them to take that action in the first place. So you need big data, you need that collection, but it's always looking back. We're trying to continually look forward. And we do that by taking a glance back at some patterns of what people have said they're doing or pockets and areas where people are living and what their biases may be or how they were raised. And we were just having, for example, a discussion this morning about how people make choices as to whether or not they take advantage of the return policy at, say, a Lululemon, and why Lululemon actually had to change their return policy to say, nope, it's only for a year now. I think I'm not, don't quote me on that, I'm not positive that it's only for a year. But when you think about what we grew up with and the fact that we grew up with this exchange and this idea of money comes out of your pocket and you give it and you receive something in exchange for that, we were partying with something and having this exchange. There's a whole other generation that grew up saying, I can return indefinitely. This is great. It's a policy that this company has. So if I don't like something anymore or it's out of style, I'll take it back. And then
people really do that?
That's why they had to change that policy. That would be why REI
like wear your yoga pants for a year and then they're like,
think? I don't like it anymore. You'd be surprised at how many people actually respond that is what they do. So it's something we're just starting to dabble in and look at, or it's a discussion that we were having just recently. Every Thursday we do Thursday lunches with our Magid Minds in each office. And so we sit and talk about just different things that we saw that were interesting that happened that could have implications for our clients and in business. But it goes deeper than that. You often look at even a workplace and the minds you're bringing around a table to have those discussions. And you have to look at your own biases, your own understandings and how each of us was raised and what we believed, or the fact that I don't have any children, and some people around the table do have children, their perception of why they do something versus why I do something. So it's always digging to that deeper why and answering those actual needs.
So I love that you say that, because that's actually one of the things I really want to do in this podcast. One of the things I see is that people are just kind of screaming at each other in social media right now. Mm-hmm. And they're not listening to each other. And I really believe it's because we're not taking the time to understand where you're coming from. What's your background? Why do you think the things that you do? Or why do you say the things that you do? And so let's dig into your background a little bit. You, fresh out of college, got to work for Anne Bancroft. Was that just an amazing experience?
It was. It was 4 months before I graduated from the university that I was hired over there as their creative director. So helping them create a brand instead of just having a logo. And they were the first two women to ski across Antarctica. And they also were educators and teachers. So they'd crafted an education program that we were launching. We had a group of kids following that that education program over in China. And so it was a small group, privately owned, but these women had this vision of what they wanted to do and achieve, but we wore a lot of hats. So you got, while I was the creative director, I was also coding the website and doing the photo shoots and helping with the clothing and the product line and picking up the phone when CNN called and wanted to take a call from the ice and hear how the expedition was going and progressing. I often joke with my husband that one of the calls we had met during this time, I've been married for 17 years, so we'd met during this time, and you ask yourself, what do two female explorers who are skiing across the landmass of Antarctica talk about? And one of the precursor calls was, I heard you had a date last night. So I tell my husband, they were talking about you! It was one question, but it was still amazing. And these are just inspiring women who say, well, I want to do something. I want to bring people along and help them understand and think about the world in a different way.
And is that about the time when you decided to just travel China by yourself with nothing but a phrase book?
Yes, it was the impetus for going to China. I wanted to check in on how these kids were using the program and how they were, because they had different tools. So we were designing a website, and we knew that this large group of school children were following the expedition, and I had to think about it from what can they actually access? How are they going to experience this? Which is why I think I focused heavily on graphic design as an emphasis for my design communications degree, because you're designing something that someone is going to use and you have to take it from their perspective. And you can think it's the best thing in the world, but if someone doesn't understand what it was without you giving an explanation and it can't stand on its own, then you didn't do your job. So I've taken that approach to all areas of my life. But yeah, that was why I wanted to go to China, was to check that out. But then I thought it was a great opportunity to scare myself. So grabbed a phrase book, learned how to finger count. I don't remember much anymore on even the finger counting. I believe this is still seven, so I could at least negotiate how to get food. And I had a friend who was at a language university, and so I flew in and spent 3 days down at the school partway through the trip, but got off the plane, met my friend, and he had arranged an apartment for me to stay with a woman who was trying to learn English. So it was a very amazing experience, but what I loved the most about it is I was alone most of the days. If I wanted to travel somewhere, he'd given me a number to call, or to go to this payphone, just dial this number and speak into it, and he had a driver that would pick me up somewhere and take me, so I didn't have to always navigate the streets on my own. Though I did love like taking the three trains to get to where you could get to an ATM and get cash out. But I loved that you had to go and try to talk to people and experience a culture without using words, and that you had to try to understand each other through gesture. And then when I lost my scarf one night and had to go back and find it and was retracing my steps alone the next day and pulling out the phrase book when I had to ask for words and at least showing them what I meant if we couldn't communicate. But it was a great exercise for me in being somewhere completely foreign where there's no chance of really picking up any bit of that, the language, to get you where you need to be, but you could still figure out how to communicate on a human level.
How did that time in China and just working with Anne Bancroft influence what you're doing today?
I think that understanding people and that level, I actually got really sick when I was in China and didn't think I would make it out. They don't turn, at that point in time, this is around 2000, they don't turn the heat on until a certain time of year. So this was Halloween time, it wasn't November yet, and I got a really bad cold and just like couldn't get warm and so congested from everything, and a woman took pity on me and led me down the street and had empathy for what I was going through, recognized that there was no way I was going to find my way to a pharmacy, explained to the pharmacist, like, she literally just had me cough, and she gave me these vials of stuff that was not fantastic tasting, but literally the second day of taking these two vials, and she explained, you know, two a day, morning and night, taking these
two
vials.
You have no idea what you're taking.
No. But I didn't think I would get out of China, really. Yeah. And I'm like, well,
bottoms up. You had to peel out a stopper, and there was like all this metal around the tip, and I was washing down with the Fanta because I could understand what Pringles and Fanta and yogurt was. There was a lot of
subsisting
on Pringles and Fanta and yogurt. And then in the evening, I would meet up with my friends. We could actually go experience other pieces of the culture, like a birthday party and other amazing parts. But that was an experience where you're trusting someone else. You're trusting in the goodness of other people, and you're recognizing that you can help each other. And I think that's something that I've brought with me. I mean, when I left, I told my parents, if you don't hear from me in 2 weeks, start with the embassy, but I will call you from LA in 2 weeks. You didn't have cell phones. You didn't know if you'd have internet access.
Right.
And
GPS.
Right. Brought a bunch of cash. They said, don't change money on the black market. That's one of the first things they did. Don't eat out of the street vendors. Yep. Did that too. And don't take cabs alone. Yeah, totally.
Or
did that.
Strange drugs from strangers.
It was a pharmacy. However, yeah, I had no idea what they were doing, but it was still an experience, and it's something that greatly impacted me, as I still vividly remember that story of someone saying, come with me. And she walked me blocks, like blocks away from where she was out of her day. Had no idea who I was.
Were you just wandering around the streets?
No, I was, yes, wandering around the streets, completely ill, looking like I was in a lot of trouble. Now, there was a bar called the Blah Blah Bar that served what they called American chicken soup. And so you go for the comforts of home, right? So then you go back to your own, what was your upbringing? What do you need from your history? What are you pulling in? And so I was eating bowl after bowl of this American chicken noodle soup. And she finally, after 2 days of seeing me, like, nope.
Yeah, got this it. Isn't going to do it for
like,
you.
Let's take a walk. And I just followed her and trusted her, and it's that communication without words, and that's really what... I mean, I have a couple of different tattoos, but they are different languages, because I think that's... If you could understand everyone in the world in their native tongue, we would have a lot more understanding. So when you go to that social media question you just asked, mm-hmm. There's not a lot of empathy. I think there's something even deeper seated there of not just understanding everyone's perspective, but understanding the stories we're telling ourselves about the words that are on that page. And what we put, the emotion we put behind things like a yes and a no, when they're just words. They just mean, yes, I can do something, no, I can't do something. And we're taking all of our own history. So it's not just understanding where they're coming from, but it's understanding what we're bringing to that conversation to shape our own interpretation of it and then our own reaction. And then all we're doing is escalating up this path instead of de-escalating and seeking first to understand. And I think that's key to any successful relationship, whether it be with your employees, whether it be with your spouse, but really saying, what are the facts, what are the stories, and how do you separate the two and make sure you're not telling yourself the stories.
So somebody clearly had empathy for you, probably saved your life, got you back to the States and your parents. Why do you think empathy is important?
I think that empathy is extremely important because it helps us step away from who we are and step into someone else's shoes. And so there's a lot in that dynamic. It's so easy to fire off a tweet or fire off a response, but truly trying to hone empathy means that you have to pause and recognize where you're coming from. You have to step into their shoes, try to imagine where they're coming from, and try to recognize that you don't have the same... You can't possibly understand exactly where they're coming from, but you have to try and see it from their perspective and recognize there's a great, I forget the exact author, but the Four Agreements, and one of them is it's never about you. So whenever someone reacts in a certain way, it's never actually about you. We all want to think it's about us, but it's not. It's never, ever about you. And think about when you have a reaction to someone and what they've done, it's not actually about them. It's about you not feeling that you're being heard. It's about you not... not having the right answer, not feeling prepared. It's never about them. It's always something. So you have to recognize when someone's coming at you or thinking that it's never about you. And then one of the other four agreements is to don't make assumptions. And so I think if we all took a pause and tried to see or understand or even ask the questions of where someone is coming from and what shaped that experience, we would all be better equipped to deal with everyday life.
So this podcast is about business. And we wanted to talk about empathy in business or the lack thereof. You're working with a number of different clients. You've worked at a number of different companies. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing empathy in the workplace today?
In some places, yes. In some places, it's not fully formed, but I think also in solutions. I think there's a tendency right now to chase the latest, greatest technology, and some of it is just great technology in the search of a need. And so there's advancements that we're making, and there's business decisions that are being made about eking out the best margin or understanding what speed to market, getting there before somebody else, instead of taking a step back and saying, but what does the actual consumer want? And I think we have to shift the conversation from this like customer journey focus and stop thinking about it in that, because even the term customer journey means I'm going to curate an experience for you that's beneficial to my business on your journey with my business versus a relationship. Mm-hmm. And some of the things, places where I recognize that someone is taking it to that relationship level is Kohl's, and it was piloting like taking back returns from Amazon. Huge, like uptick of 50-some% of new people coming through the door at Kohl's. That's having a relationship. Those 54 or 50 whatever percent that were coming through those doors now, those aren't people who were on a journey with Kohl's. They were on a journey with Amazon, but Kohl's decided to have a relationship with them.
Yeah, apparently they got off the journey with Amazon.
Right. Or they need to return it, and they just wanted to be able to do something in person. So it's solving an unmet need. Mm-hmm. It's recognizing that those lockers are great, and we can find them everywhere and stick our stuff back in them, but maybe someone wants to talk to a person, and someone said, I'd rather have a relationship, and while it's not benefiting my, it shouldn't benefit my business in that way, and you wouldn't think that that's going to help, it's going to benefit your business by bringing new people in and having them have a different experience in this retail setting. And I think that's where the empathy piece really comes in and can be used in business. Think about, I have Comcast. I don't know if you have Comcast. But the remote control that you can talk into, we didn't even have to set it up. I didn't even know I had it until my nieces and nephews came and like showed me that it was using it. But that's having empathy and designing a solution around a need that wasn't met of an easier way to search through, searching through your content options. Yeah. But there was no setup.
Way just, better than calling customer service.
Or looking through that ridiculous list of you want and trying to figure out or searching out. You just can talk into it. And there was no setup, and they thought about it to that nth degree. And so I think having empathy allows you to design better solutions, and everyone recognizes good design, but great design should be seamless. It's just part of, it folds right into that piece of your life. And so while we can chase profits and dollars, there's only so much efficiency you can eke out of something. But if you don't solve a consumer need and you don't think about human context, all the big data in the world isn't going to save you, because you're not pushing it forward in a different direction, a more human direction, in something that's sustainable and ownable and matters to people.
If companies aren't doing human-centered design or having empathy today, how would you suggest they get started? I mean, how do you even think about that?
Hire us. No, talk to people. But yes, hire us. But talking to people, being aware of what's going on, watching the things and the pain points in your life and making note of them. You know, the gratitude journaling is great, but also the that was a little rougher than I expected, or these are things that annoy me in my life. It's starting to recognize empathy and recognize points where there's opportunity. But I think there's also this idea in the workplace of bringing different voices to a table and not assuming that someone has to pay their dues to have a voice. And that's something I love that we embrace at Magid. I was in a room with one of our interns and our CEO, and we were talking through one of our latest proprietary studies that had come out of field. And there was a slide that was up that just had a standard, you know, this is the standard, the millennials haven't settled down in how they're in their consumption pattern, and neither have the plurals on how they're going to consume media and where they're going to be getting their information from. And our intern piped in and said, actually, that is the pattern. And you know, we dip in and out of things and we move beyond. And instead of, she felt safe to speak up. And so it's creating safe spaces. It's allowing people in those rooms and allowing them as in that conversation and recognizing that we all have a different perspective that helps shape these rich insights. But then it's also having the right people in leadership who can say, tell us more. And that's exactly what my CEO did, and myself, is saying, tell us more about that. Tell us more about your perspective and where this is leading. And it became a really great insight that we could take back to our clients who are saying they're pirating, they're sharing all their passwords and they're pirating this, but you haven't made it easy for them. And so they are going to figure it out, because they're a generation who had a phone in their pocket and they had an app for this and they could figure that out. They're not overwhelmed by choice. We talk, you often hear the paradox of choice, and we might be overwhelmed by choices when we get into a store. I'm in this space, and I have stood in front of lotion was the latest one, and I'm like, I want something that's paraben free and this, and at Whole Foods no less, and still was nope. I'm just going to leave and make my husband figure it out when I get home. This is what I want. Could you just go find that on Amazon and send it over? But that paradox of choice doesn't exist in some people where they're like, no, I'll just try another brand and I'll try this and I'll dip in and out. And this is why a Birchbox or a Stitch Fix works for some people. But it's allowing those voices at the table and allowing ego to step out of the room. And instead of worrying about what space you're carving out, looking for the best and greatest ideas.
I love that. Super great insight on how to think about your customers. What if we shifted that question and started to think about having empathy for employees?
Yes. I mean, it is hugely lacking, and the same principles exactly apply, is pulling voices into a room and empowering them. But I think it's also, it has to be empowered by leadership. But it has to be something, you can't force culture, right? You have to allow culture to, you have to create a space, and then you have to allow culture to grow within that and organically grow. Otherwise, it's not ownable, so it's not real, it's not authentic. So leadership has to be on board with this, but then it's bringing those voices and asking them. There's so many business challenges and employee challenges that have answers within those walls, but it's asking the right people. It's bringing in the actuaries. It's bringing in finance. It's bringing in the new, fresh folks and asking them to come up with different ideas or be open to say, what should we stop doing? What should we start doing? What should we continue doing?
And following through, right?
Yeah, and not just, and answering not just when they have a complaint. Like, I don't have a lot of tolerance for complaining. I have a tolerance for, tell me what we should do about it. And give me 3 or 4 options, and then let's talk about the best options. Then let's decide which ones we can implement, and leaders can set aside budgets. I mean, that's where they have more fiduciary control, but employees have a lot of ideas for shaping the place they want to be, and recognizing that there's not a lot of pensions anymore. We're having a lot of issues with retention, and you're having to retool people. So I think you have to think also about, what do these employees want out of it, and shape your space for culture to be created on that and that understanding. So for example, with my own teams, I like asking them, look at your LinkedIn every year. Tell me what you wish you said you were saying you could do. And maybe this comes because I have a creative background and spent time in the ad agency world and at Fallon. If you weren't building your book that as a creative, if you weren't winning awards, if you weren't adding to your portfolio, you were gone and you'd lose your talent. And that is true also of business people and executives and people coming up in their careers. If you're on the business side of the world, not just the creative side, you want to be adding to your toolkit as well. So thinking about it in that space of, okay, what do you wish you were saying? And if I can help you get there, I will. And if you hit a ceiling here and there's no other way for you to learn and grow and add to your career toolkit, I'll help you find a job. And let's have an honest dialogue and take it from that human approach. Many of us have come from a lot of different places and worked a lot of different places. So why would we assume that someone is going to be with us forever? And why aren't we instead trying to have empathy for what they're trying to do in their life to want to have that retention within our own walls? And then recognize that if we open that door to have a very honest conversation and say, if I can change it, I will. And if I can give you more opportunities, I will. And if I can't, I'll help you find something else. That means you get the best work out of them until the last minute that they walk out the door in that organization, and they help build it along the way. And they're willing to come back if something changes in the organization or hire you if they're ever in a position where they need your services. So you build that network, and we have to think a little more globally about how we care for our employees and not just think about them as our employees, but people that are going to be within our sphere and our workplace for the rest of our careers.
Companies can get productivity, retention, new ideas. What else do you think they can benefit from by applying empathy, not only to customers, but employees?
Well, I think you hit on a lot of the highlights, and I think it's that culture creation as well. Of if we all understand where we're coming from and we stop using this term work-life balance, I mean, if you really started to unpack, like, where did that come from? And think about, well, there was a point in time when someone actually left the home and they went to work and they had to drive somewhere and there was no way to passively even keep up on your family. So there's no social anything. You wouldn't call, you couldn't pick up a phone. Like, you had a desk and pencils and paper. And so that really was a separation of work and life. And that doesn't exist anymore. So if we start to think more in those terms, I think you get a more energized people. You spend less time spinning on ideas and you get more buy-in to move the company forward. So if all people feel heard, even if the idea that they had isn't what's implemented, but if they feel heard and brought along on that process, that's where transformational change can actually happen.
We've talked a lot about empathy, and we've talked a lot about social media and what different corporations are doing around empathy. But as you're just being exposed to all the different negative headlines, the way people are treating people with having those screens in front of them, do you think that we're losing empathy in this world?
I think it's a really interesting question and timely question. And I think that when you consider that people can log on and not have a face and a name, it doesn't have to be their picture, it doesn't have to be their Instagram account, it doesn't have to be, they have their Finstagram accounts where it's their fake Instagram accounts for the people that they really care about versus their Instagram accounts that they're curating. And we're putting out these other personas in the world and we can say things without our names attached and without having to put a stake in the ground. I think it has this ripple effect of us putting things out in the world and not choosing to see people as people. And you and I were discussing this at another point in time of how we even refer to employees within the workplace. I know we're having this conversation the other day. And I think it stems right down to that, the lexicon that we have put in place, the words that we choose. And I come from the ad agency world, or that was part of my background. I was at Fallon for 4 years, and we called it talent. And you had your talent folks, not your HR folks, and everyone was talent. So you felt good about coming to work. Everyone got a business card because you felt good about having that business card. Not, well, I mean, does the admins really need a business card? Yes, everyone needs to feel equal value. All of those are tickets to empathy and whether or not you're including someone in a conversation, right down to whether you shake or hug, right? If you're not going to hug everyone in the office, you better not hug anyone in the office because it creates a divide. If you don't shake hands of everyone the way you refer to them, et cetera. But getting to that, how we talk about people. So it was talent at Fallon. I then was at Disney down in Florida, and it was cast members. And the way they brought empathy forward there is, one, we all wore name tags because everyone in the entire company wore them. The park employees had to wear name tags. We wore name tags. I thought it was fantastic because I'm not always great at remembering names. So to always see a face and a name, that also made everyone human. So while it was an empathy thing of building camaraderie within the culture and with us understanding what the park employees had to do, it also meant that we all could talk to each other and use a first name. And so it took away some of those barriers on something so simple. And I'll also say they designed something very human. It wasn't a pin name tag. It had a magnet, so you didn't have to ruin your clothes. Put that on, which brilliant. I thought was brilliant. Honestly, to me, like, that's great design. Nobody even noticed it, but I recognized it as a human-centered designer of, like, thank you for thinking about who's going to be plugging this into their shirts and ruining clothes. Then another thing that Disney did is one week out of the year, we would go into the parks and you'd work in the parks. So you experienced what it was like at lunch rush when there's a line out the back and dad's coming back up and he forgot to buy milk and his baby's crying and people have to make decisions. Food is moving everywhere. That gives you huge empathy for what you're asking these employees to do. They also would never, you know, shut down the parks. They cared a lot about the consumer experience, the human experience, and what that experience was. So if we wanted to do photo shoots, you had to do it at 4 a.m. Right as the sun came up, you had to be out before the park started. So they thought about that on every single level, and I think that made everything more human. When I went to United Health Group, I was introduced to my human capital partner. Different turn of phrase, different choice of words, and I bristled at it because I'd never experienced that before. However, they still allowed us to create a space. So I helped build Carrot, and Carrot had 5 offices around the country. And Amanda had this great idea of, let's have everyone meet everyone. And so thank goodness UHG really believed in that as well and let us manage our budgets the way we wanted to. So it was up to the individual leader to say, I don't like that construct in those words. And so I'm going to make sure that we all have a system and a vehicle where we can go out and see face-to-face. So we send people to the different offices. We created a passport program and get your stamp from the different offices. And it mattered. We got so much more work done after you spent some time looking someone in the eye and you could at least picture them having the conversation with you. They become human again. So social and tech and online and phone calls and virtual working spaces are great, but there's a need for seeing someone and looking them in the eye and understanding that they are a person as well. And then you can envision how they're actually speaking and saying and responding to you. Also at Allianz, for example, when I was there as their director of brand, the first couple of weeks you spent in training and you did a job shadow. So you did step-ins. So you would go down to the call center and you would sit and watch what they had to put up with. It made you more empathetic to how you were designing something on the front end. You went down to talk to the actuaries and see what their days looked like. You did a step in on the desks and the sales desk to understand what kind of questions they were fielding and how they were helping to move everything forward. So by sitting with someone for even that amount of time meant when we had a three-year project to upgrade some of the systems on the operations side, everyone understood why it was important. So they slowed down to speed up. While they wanted you in that job and they wanted you doing the job they hired you for, it meant more to them to spend that time to slow down so that you never had this disgruntled, but why can't we spend money on this? No, it's really important that they don't have to toggle between all of those screens, and that would make their lives much more efficient and easy and happier. Yeah. So I think that's huge. When I came to Magid, my first initiative was to meet everyone in the company. And because we're spread out, we have offices in New York, LA, Minneapolis, Iowa, and a lot of our Iowa crew, they're deployed across the country. So they're constantly traveling. These people are on the road all the time. So it was GChat. Everyone had to do a Google chat with me so I could at least see faces. Because to me, that's if you're going to talk about why are you here, why are you passionate about what you're doing, and you can't see that expression and see a little bit of their world, it's really hard to build that empathy. So technology has a place, flexible working spaces, absolutely needed in this day and age, and we should embrace that technology but understand that there are people behind it. And if we don't spend that time or don't slow down to speed up, we're not going to pull empathy back into our day-to-day lives. So I think you're seeing a shift in society now. I was just reading an article from the New York Times that someone from our LA office sent on JOMO. We've all heard of FOMO, the fear of missing out. And now that we're like 11 years into these smartphones and this amazing connection to the world, there is this JOMO of joy of missing out. Put your phone away. And you see more and more of tech-free vacations. I know my husband and I made a commitment to always take a two-week vacation together. So the first week I could stop shaking from being away from my office and computer and email. Second week we could actually have vacation and reconnect. And same for him, though he was a lot better at it than I was of separating. But the second week of vacation, we literally would find places that had no cell phone reception because I had to physically remove the belief that I could.
Yeah.
In order to disconnect.
Yeah, I go out of the country to like dead spots purposely.
Right. Right.
Just to be like, oh, sorry, you can't get me. I'm in Cuba.
I mean, remember when it was awesome to travel because you'd go to the airport with a book and no one could get a hold of you because there was no Wi-Fi on the plane?
Yes.
And now we can be connected.
I'm dreading if they let you have cell service on airplanes.
No, that would be
no, please.
I don't. Yeah. We need think time. And I think that's the other piece is we can push ourselves into that technology zone and we have to be think about our own needs and take some empathy cues for ourselves as well and say, you also need to recharge and reinvigorate yourself and have time to read and have time to experience have a conversation with the person next to you on the plane and understand where they're coming from. I mean, that's a great example of just gaining a little empathy and asking people about them and try to ask them five questions before you say one thing about yourself.
You mean the person stuck in the middle seat?
Right. Right.
Have some empathy
that
there.
Person, a lot of empathy there. Don't do this when you sit down. Armrest down, arms out. Yeah. No, exactly.
Well, good. Great points, really deep insight. You guys are doing great work at Magid, obviously, around human-centered design. If people want to get a hold of you and hire you to do this or learn more about what you're doing, what would you suggest?
Magid.com or go ahead and email me directly. It's bmiller@magid.com, M-A-G-I-D.
Yep, and so it's magid.com?
Correct, yep.
Well, thank you so much for being with us
today. Thanks for having me. Yeah. Great conversation.
Thanks again for joining us at The Business Gist today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did, and hopefully you also got a new perspective. I'm always looking for feedback, so hit me up on social media at TheBizGist or send me an email at megan@thebusinessgist.com. Megan is spelled M-E-G-A-N, and of course, Gist is spelled G-I-S-T. Special thank you goes to our sponsors, Minnesota Business Magazine and North 401 Studios, and, of course, my amazing team, our director, Tricky Mickey, a.k.a. Mickey Mossman, our producer, Alex Stadnick, and our production assistant, Marge Pearson. Until next time, have a great day, and in the meantime, make sure to check us out at thebusinessgist.com.